On this week's Brewbound podcast, we talk to the founders of Briggs Hard Seltzer, an upstart hard seltzer brand based in the Boston area. We're also going to update you on all the latest news from the last week or so, introduce a new segment called WTF, share some bad PR pitches that have crossed our desk during this holiday season, and celebrate the return of Buy 'Em a Beer. But before we get to all that, we want to tell you all about advertising with Brewbound. There are a variety of ways you can reach Brewbound's industry audience, including through our daily newsletter, which lands in more than 20,000 inboxes across the world. With the purchase of an eBlast, your fully customizable HTML email message will be sent directly to our newsletter subscribers, allowing you to showcase a new product or service or to make an important announcement. Or maybe you'd rather promote your expertise and thought leadership. If so, consider creating a piece of native content that will receive thousands of impressions and live on Brewbound indefinitely. In addition to eBlast and native content on brewbound.com, there are a variety of ways to engage the Brewbound community through event sponsorship, digital banner ads, job postings, marketplace listings, and even this podcast. For more information, drop us a line at sales@brewbound.com. That's sales@brewbound.com. Okay, let's go. Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Brewbound podcast presented by BevNet, where we bring you interviews with some of the most well-known figures throughout the beer industry. Today is Thursday, December 13th, and my name is Chris Frenari, the editor of Brewbound. I'm finally joined once again by my co-host, fellow Brewbound editor, Justin Kendall.
Reunited, and it feels so good, Chris. How lonely did you get doing the podcast alone?
I mean, it was a little bit lonely. Recording without anyone else in the studio can be a daunting task, but I was up for the challenge. And I will say I missed your scent. I missed your musk. For a moment there, I suggested to myself, maybe Justin and I should get a place and move in together when this is all over.
We've already tried that once. I think there might be dog hair still in your place as a forever reminder of Dusty.
Now, this is true. Justin did move into Casa de Fern for a brief period. What was that, earlier this summer in between moves?
I think so. Like, well, maybe spring.
It was only a few days, but your dog's hair is certainly not missed. I'll tell you that much. I'll tell you what I have been missing, though, and that's being back here in our Boston studios with a complete episode for our listeners. I think our last three podcasts have been shortened or altered as a result of our crazy travel schedules out west for Brewbound Live and some of our other conferences at BevNet here. We did BevNet Live for non-alcoholic entrepreneurs. We put on a cannabis forum. We did Nosh Live. So we had a ton of events out west, but it's good to finally be back in the groove and giving our listeners what they really want at the top of the podcast, which is the news.
Well, I've got some good news for you. We've got three recent stories to catch everyone up on, so here goes. Anheuser-Busch, the world's largest beer manufacturer, has eliminated nearly 40 jobs throughout North America. According to AB, the changes, which affect a small number of salaried positions, are intended to better align our operations with our commercial strategy and to further reduce complexity. Last week's cuts come about 15 months after AB eliminated nearly 2% of its North American workforce in a move that impacted approximately 350 employees.
Yeah, Anheuser-Busch is just one of a handful of U.S. beer companies that has downsized in 2018. Just about every major beer company has responded to slowing beer sales by making cuts, including Miller Coors, Constellation Brands, and Pabst Brewing Company. And a number of craft breweries have also scaled back their workforces, including Lagunitas, New Belgium, Green Flash, and Avery Brewing, among others.
We also have an update on last week's Trillium Brewing Company controversy. For those who may have missed it, Trillium came under fire after a former employee raised questions about the Massachusetts craft brewery's labor practices and brewing methods in the Beer Advocate online forum. The former employee claimed that Trillium cut the pay of longtime retail workers as well as cut corners in the brewing process by dumping tequila into beer that was advertised as barrel-aged. I spoke with Trillium founders JC and Esther Tetro last week, and they told me that in response, they're raising the hourly base pay for their 35 retail workers from between $5 and $8 an hour to between $15 and $18 an hour, plus tips. The Tetros also addressed another claim the former employee made, saying they never poured spirits into their kegs of beer. And lastly, the Brewers Association has released its annual Year in Beer Review for 2018. A few quick takeaways from the report. Growth of BA-defined craft breweries is stable and steady, with mid-year volume growth of 5%, according to the trade association. The BA did note, however, that there were signs of slower second-half growth, and BA chief economist Bart Watson has said that the final number may come in a point or two lower. The craft brewing industry's economic impact is also now estimated to be more than $76 billion, and the number of brewers in the U.S. officially eclipsed 7,000 at the end of October, with potentially 1,000 new breweries opening in 2018.
Sounds like there's still some growth opportunities out there for smaller breweries, many of which are selling directly to consumers, as you all know. But I would suspect that amongst the top 50 breweries in 2018, it'll be a pretty similar story as the last couple of years, where half of the breweries in that group of top 50 were either flat or in decline, both in 2017 and 2016. That is, of course, unless they all start rolling out hard seltzer. In the last couple weeks, we've gotten word from a number of craft breweries, including the Canarchy-owned Oscar Blues and Perrin Brewing Operations, as well as Noda Brewing and Platform Beer Company, who have recently introduced or plan to introduce hard seltzer to their portfolios. We know that brands like White Claw and Truly, produced by Mike's and Boston Beer, respectively, are performing incredibly well this year, and now smaller companies are trying to get in on the action. One of those companies is Briggs Hard Seltzer, a Boston-area startup that is exclusively focused on the production of hard seltzer made with 100% real fruit. The company was founded in 2016 by two friends, Michael Kirsten and Neil Quigley, who launched their first product, a cranberry-flavored hard seltzer, into the world in 2017. The company has since rebranded and reformulated its original product and added two additional flavors, a grapefruit and pineapple flavor. I got the chance to sit down with Neil and Michael this summer to chat about how their brand has evolved over the last 2 years, the opportunities they see for higher-end hard seltzer brands in the market, and where they see the hard seltzer segment going in the future. A couple of fun facts about Neil. He was actually the former head brewer at Farmer Willie's Ginger Beer, which you now all know as Willie's Super Brew, the winners of the 2018 Brewbound Pitch Slam. He was also one of the youngest people ever to pass the certified Cicerone test at just 20 years and 6 months of age. He had to go up to Canada, where he has partial citizenship there, to take it, because you're not allowed to take the Cicerone test if you're under 21 in the U.S. So fun fact about Neil. So without further ado, here it is, our interview with Michael Kirsten and Neil Quigley, the founders of Briggs Hard Seltzer. Chris here with Brewbound, and I'm with the founders of Briggs Hard Seltzer today. I'll let you guys introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about how you got started with an emerging hard seltzer brand, a pretty nascent category that's still kind of finding its way. Tell us about your product and who you are.
Definitely. So my name is Michael Kirsten. I'm the co-founder of Briggs Hard Seltzer.
And I'm Neil Quigley. I'm the other co-founder.
So I guess let's start from the very beginning. Why Briggs and why Briggs Hard Seltzer? So in 10th grade, Neil and I had been best friends forever. We both grew up in Newton, right outside of Boston. And I got my first iPhone. It was like the iPhone 2. And I texted Neil, "What's up, bro?" You know, high school. And it auto-corrected to Briggs. What's up, Briggs? And so ever since then, we were kind of like, ha-ha, Briggs, like hilarious. And basically, when we kind of joined minds and thought about launching this product and this company, you know, Briggs was the obvious choice.
What gives you guys the confidence to know that a small, scrappy, bootstrap startup without an office, I guess, at this point, can thrive in a category that's, you know, really still kind of finding its footing?
That's a really good question. What gives us the confidence? I don't know. It's a very hard question to answer. But to start with the first part of the question that you asked, you know, where did this idea come from? Why did we decide to launch this brand? Originally, Michael and I really just wanted to do a product with all real fruit. And, you know, Michael and I both love good quality ingredients. And I had a background in brewing, so we knew we wanted to do something in the alcohol space. And we decided we wanted to use cranberries, as the fruit of Massachusetts. We're both from here. So we launched this product with all real cranberries last year. And, you know, we really saw the hard seltzer space exploding. And we thought, you know, that's the perfect space to get into. It's everything that we love. It's doing really well. It's a hot category. And it's a perfect application for using real fruit. You know, you see companies like Deep Eddy Vodka or Spindrift who are making, you know, waves in their segments by the use of real fruit. And we thought, you know, why not do the same thing in the hard seltzer category? You know, we only launched that one cranberry flavor last year, but now, you know, we've expanded and we've launched a pineapple flavor and a grapefruit to really take advantage of, you know, different people's taste preferences and palates.
How are you guys, and I'll let you guys keep going because, I mean, you guys have so much passion. You can totally feel it for the product that you have. But how are you guys going to communicate that to customers, that it is a product made with real fruit, that it is, you know, something different than, you know, one of the other more mainstream seltzers that just has like a natural flavor component added to it?
So when we first launched, the product was called Briggs Original Boston Cranberry. And to your point, how do we get people to understand the difference between our product and the competitors? That was a challenge for us in the beginning with Briggs Original Boston Cranberry. And we ran, you know, 10 to 15 tastings a weekend, 1 ounce at a time, explaining to customers what this product is, why it's better than the competition. And people really started to understand that and grasp it once we were there to educate the consumer. But the issue is, you know, we can't reach every single consumer that would be interested in our product with a physical 1 ounce sample. So over this last 6 to 8 months, we've gone through a full rebrand. We've also reformulated the product and brought the price down and changed the packaging from 4 to 6 packs. But basically, we wanted to be a lot more education forward with our product and packaging. So what you see now has Briggs Hard Seltzer. That's the umbrella of the brand. It's very self-describing of what the actual product is. It's a hard seltzer. And then you see that box that says made with 100% real fruit. And that really conveys a message to the consumer that this product is different than the competitors, not natural flavors or, you know, all natural ingredients. It's actually made with real fruit. In the reformulation, Neil will talk about this a little bit more. Our products all have colors in them. Unfiltered fruit really shows off the true real fruit that we're using in the product, and something that none of our competitors do. All of them are using, you know, the space and adding natural or artificial flavors and added sugar. And our product really not only looks different, but is also branded a little bit differently as well.
Yeah. So to talk a little bit about, you know, the reformulation we did and what we were going for there. And like Michael said, the product has this beautiful real color to it because obviously, you know, fruit, it has a gorgeous color. Pineapples have a beautiful hue, cranberry, especially even the grapefruit. So when you pour out the product, you know, you can see a really nice juicy color. It looks fresh. Whereas in our old product, we actually had to filter after adding some of the fruit, and we had to add preservatives just because of our production capabilities. And, you know, we weren't quite making the exact product we wanted. And part of our reformulation was to be able to make, you know, the exact product that we wanted. And that is really one of the simplest, freshest, and, you know, most easy to drink alcoholic products on the market. And it's as simple as just water, naturally fermented sugar, and fruit juice. We flash pasteurize the product so that way we don't have to add any preservatives. We don't have to filter out any of the fruit. So all you really get is this really light, clean taste with a nice splash of real juice. And it speaks for itself.
Yeah. And it's interesting to hear you talk and describe the color element of the drinking experience, which I think is, you know, something that Spindrift also kind of latches onto when they're comparing themselves to a product like LaCroix or Polar or any other non-alcoholic seltzer. And one of the differentiation points that they always point to is, hey, well, if you pour out our product into a glass, you're going to see that it does have color from the real fruit. How do you, I guess, get the consumer to take that next step versus just drinking it from the can? And because I think that will really help people understand the difference between the products that they're drinking.
Definitely. So to touch on that a little bit, we're still running 15 to 20 tastings a week, and we pour them into clear 1 ounce sample glasses. So everyone who's at our tastings understands and sees that the product has color in it. We're also really active on social media, and we've built out our social media platforms. Nothing major, nothing huge, but we've put some attention and detail into it. And at this point, you know, we're really going to start incorporating that messaging even heavier into our social media and really blasting out that message that this product does have real fruit and showing that off visually to the consumers.
Yeah. So where are you guys sold right now? What's the price point? What's been your sort of initial experience with competing against some of the big guys?
So right now we're sold in Massachusetts only. We will be available in Rhode Island in about 2 weeks from now, something we're super excited for. The price point on the shelf, it generally comes in around $9.99. We are very similarly priced to the other seltzers on the market. And that was something that Michael and I felt was really important. You know, we don't want to outprice ourselves or price ourselves out of the market, excuse me, because we really are offering a similar product. And we want people who are drinking, you know, regular hard seltzers on a day-to-day basis to drink our product on a day-to-day basis. So we are priced similarly, $9.99 on the shelf at most locations.
Was there a discussion about having a higher price point to really drive home the message that you guys are higher end?
Definitely. So, you know, to speak to that a little bit, when we first came out with our product, Briggs Original Boston Cranberry, about a year ago, we were looking at $8.99 to $9.99 for a 4-pack. And generally, our competitors are coming in right around that $8.99 mark for a 6-pack. So at most accounts, we're 50 cents to a dollar more expensive. But coming in under that $10 mark makes our product really approachable to the general consumers, especially in the hard seltzer space. You know, we collected a lot of data, a lot of information from the consumers at these tastings that we were running last year over the past, you know, 6 to 8 months. And we've used a lot of that information to maximize not only the efficiency of the product, but also the pricing structure and, you know, the approachability factor that we're trying to provide to the consumer.
Who is the hard seltzer consumer? I mean, I think that's still a big question mark right now. Early on, it was female consumers, and it was a little bit unclear as to, you know, what the long-term prospects would be for hard seltzer brands. But I think a lot of companies have found that there are a lot of different types of people drinking hard seltzer. What have you guys seen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's super accurate. When hard seltzer first launched, there was definitely this connotation of, you know, it's a very feminine drink. There's a lot of maybe college age or young professional females drinking it. People who are trying to worry about their looks or whatever by having less calories. But I think it's becoming a lot more commonplace and becoming a lot more popular with a whole diverse group of consumers just because it's a very high-quality beverage. People like light, refreshing drinks. They like things that are easy to drink, especially in the summer. And there's a lot of people who just like regular seltzer. And if you're a regular seltzer drinker, chances are you're going to like hard seltzer. So, you know, personally, I drink a ton of non-alcoholic seltzer. And when I first saw the hard seltzer category emerging, I thought to myself, you know, there's no way I'm going anywhere near that. But now I drink it all the time because it's a, you know, it's an amazing beverage and it's a good thing to drink for anybody. So what my partner over here, Michael, was miming to me a moment ago was that the consumer for hard seltzer is anybody who can taste. And that's something that we actually heard in an interview with Nick Shields and Dave Holmes, the founders of Spiked Seltzer. And it's something that we've said to ourselves time and time again after that. And it's a really good point. You know, anyone who really likes a quality beverage, who cares about what they're drinking, or who just wants something light and refreshing could be a great hard seltzer consumer.
Yeah.
And just to build on to that a little bit, when you look at the large market data, we're seeing a large trend towards light premium beverages. And Spiked Seltzer fits into that category really perfectly. It's light, it's low calorie, it's low sugar, it's easy to drink. And there's really a very nice amount of quality that goes into this type of product. You know, when you look at a lot of other categories in the alcohol space, you know, there aren't many ingredient lists, there aren't many nutrition facts. And this space is kind of bringing that out. And we're very happy to show off our ingredient list and our nutrition fact. All of our products have under 110 calories, between 4 and 6 grams of sugar, 5% alcohol. And like Neil said, we use that cold brewed sugar base. So 5% ABV, and it's naturally gluten-free.
And to interject, another really great thing to note about our product is we have no added sugar. So all of the sugar in our product is coming strictly from the fruit. So whatever naturally occurs in the fruit is what we end up with in the product. So we don't add any, you know, cane sugar or artificial sweeteners or anything like that. It's 100% natural.
Now, who are your direct competitors in that sort of premium set? Because I haven't seen too many other, you know, higher end or brands that are at least positioning themselves to be higher end hard seltzers other than, you know, some of the mainstream players.
So I think that comes back to the first question that you asked, which is what makes us confident about entering this space that's full of really large companies, large corporate alcohol companies and conglomerations. And I think it's the fact that we're creating a premium product where there really aren't any other premium products in the space. You know, there's companies out there that are branding themselves as premium products or, you know, positioning themselves to different markets and demographics. But when it comes down to it, the product inside of those cans is very similar from that you'd find in a Spiked, a Truly, or a White Claw. And we're kind of the first company in the space to take ourselves out of that bubble and to create something different with a really high quality premium ingredient product.
Do you need other people to enter the space that you're trying to play in order for there to be more buzz, more awareness, and I guess more of a segment within a segment? Or are you guys happy kind of dominating that niche for the time being?
I think we're happy dominating that niche for the time being. We've positioned ourselves really strongly in the market. You know, we're building those really personal relationships with the retailers that's necessary for a company of our size. We're out there in the market, in the field every single day, making sales calls, running these tastings, getting information and feedback from our end consumers. And we're really tapped into what people are looking for. And I think that gives us a really strong advantage as to where, you know, Spiked Seltzer, White Claw, Truly, they're going out there and they're spending millions of dollars on national ad campaigns and really educating the general public into what a hard seltzer is. And we're kind of here in the liquor stores on the ground, you know, showing people store by store that there's a better option out there.
Yeah. And for the most part, hard seltzer has established itself in the off-premise, and it's been a product that hasn't, you know, at least in my experience, really shown up at bars or restaurants. I guess first and foremost, what do you guys see as sort of the occasion for drinking a hard seltzer? And two, you know, will that occasion ever be at an on-premise account? And if so, you know, how do you start to build that piece of the category?
Yeah, I think we've seen the exact same thing for sure. I mean, there's definitely not as much of an on-premise presence with hard seltzer as there is in the retail stores. And that's something that Michael and I talk about all the time, actually, because, you know, like you said, what is the appropriate time to drink a hard seltzer? And right now, people definitely are considering hard seltzer to be, you know, an active beverage, something that you would have while you're, you know, out on the beach or while you're hiking or while you're at a party. And I don't think people have quite gotten their minds around the idea of drinking hard seltzer at a bar yet. It's starting to pop up. It's starting to appear, but it doesn't quite make sense to people yet. And something that, you know, we actually feel like we are doing well and we've positioned ourselves in a nice spot to do this is be on-premise and have those on-premise accounts, whether it be on draft or in can. You know, we are a slightly more premium product. We are made with real fruit. We have that color that we spoke about earlier. And I think it's a little bit more, it seems a little bit more reasonable. It seems almost more like drinking a hard cider in that type of situation where it's more of a craft beverage rather than just something that, you know, like other spiked seltzers where you would just drink it for the effects or for the fact that it's, you know, easy to drink on a hot day on the beach. So, you know, there's a lot of really good fresh fruit flavor in this product. And, you know, it's something that is enjoyable to drink strictly because it tastes great.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the cider category, which has traditionally really struggled to go beyond sort of 1% or so market share of the total beer category. In general, you know, what's sort of the size of the prize for hard seltzer? Where do you see the entire category going, you know, long term? And is it something that can be bigger than cider in your minds? And I realize I'm asking, you know, two hard seltzer entrepreneurs that, so you might be a little biased, but where do you see this all going?
I think the least biased answer I can give you is that if you look at the core of what the product is and the core of what hard seltzer is, being intended for that socially active, health-conscious consumer, and the fact that that trend is growing so rapidly and becoming so popular, even on the mainstream, I'd say the upside for hard seltzer is large. I won't go out and say on record that I think it's going to be bigger than hard cider, but I think that it's going to continue to grow long term. I don't see this as a flash in the pan as we saw with hard soda. I think that this is the type of beverage that people are going to latch onto in more and more different scenes. I think that the trends are pointing towards long term growth. I mean, even what Neil said earlier, right? It started out as mostly young professional females, and now we're seeing this becoming more and more popular amongst the general public, men, women, young, older. And I think that those kind of small trends that we're seeing in this short time frame are good indicators that this is a long-term play.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, kind of away from hard seltzer and more just to entrepreneurship in general. You guys are pretty young. You guys just launched this business. I mean, what's going through your heads as new entrepreneurs in the beverage space? And have you thought about kind of the road ahead and, you know, where you guys just personally want to go and, you know, what your goals are as business owners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to speak to like where at least my head is at right now, I mean, it's stressful. Obviously, as any entrepreneur knows, it's not easy and you're waking up every day thinking about your business. It's been really cool to see how Michael and I have developed as entrepreneurs over the last year or 2 years, because
I'll tell you right now, at the beginning, we were stressing, you know, even though the stakes were lower, we were stressing out more than we are now. You know, you kind of learn what matters and what doesn't and where to put your focus and energy and, you know, how to deal with that stress. So, you know, I feel a lot better now than I did when we first started, even though the stakes are higher and I have a lot more responsibility and more, you know, to manage. But, you know, it's exciting to get the company going. It's exciting to make inroads and to see some success. And I think from listening to podcasts like Taste Radio, you know, or How I Built This, or reading, you know, stories from other entrepreneurs is a really good way to get a little bit more level-headed and realize, you know, everybody goes through these types of issues. Everybody has these big roadblocks and, you know, you have to kind of go with the flow and make sure it doesn't, you know, get you too down.
What's been the biggest lesson that you guys have learned so far? And, you know, maybe one of the hardest things that you've had to overcome just in your short amount of time operating this business?
Sure. So when we first launched the business, you know, Briggs Original Boston Cranberry was the product. And Neil and I were very excited about launching Briggs Original Boston Cranberry. We knew that the hard seltzer market was hot. We were really excited that we were going to be this kind of premium ingredient, local hard seltzer in the Massachusetts market. And I think that excitement maybe blinded us a little bit to what exactly we were trying to do and what we thought we could actually expect to do. I know, at least personally myself, I was very overexcited, the projections that we were making and the numbers that we were putting out. And what we realized really quickly was that it takes a lot of hard work and it's a daily grind and you kind of have to chip away at it one day at a time. It doesn't matter how good your product is. You have to get people to try it. You have to get people interested in the story. And if you're not able to do that, you could have the best product ever and it's not going to succeed. And I think that that's probably the biggest lesson that at least personally I've learned is that nothing ever just blows up overnight. You know, it takes years and years of hard work to make something blow up overnight. And so, you know, we're chipping away at it one day at a time, as many tastings as we can do a week, building the most authentic brand that we can build. And I think that that daily grind, and it becomes yearly grind, is what's going to differentiate us from these competitors that are so large in the space and create a really authentic connection between us and the end consumer.
Yeah. Hard seltzer, it's an alcoholic product, obviously. So you're paying close attention to what's happening in the beer space and the cider space and just the alcohol space in general. But the brand and the type of beverage it is in some ways, you know, more similar to a non-alcoholic product. And, you know, you brought up some of the seltzers like LaCroix or Spindrift. Where do you guys spend most of your time focusing on trends? Is it in the seltzer category or is it in the alcohol space? And just, I guess, as entrepreneurs, what box do you kind of put yourselves into?
So the best answer is we don't like to put ourselves into a box.
Of course
but,
not.
I think that realistically, that's a really good point. I think we do focus really, really heavily on the NA space, the non-alcoholic space, because like you said, there are a lot of similarities between our product and non-alcoholic beverage brands. You know, we're really not appealing to the same consumer that craft beer is. We're kind of appealing to some of the same consumers as hard cider. But the non-alcoholic space, it makes a lot of sense. You know, what those people are doing with branding, what they're doing with, you know, the concepts behind their products, what's selling, what's going over well, because, you know, we are an alternative alcoholic beverage. You know, it is for somebody who doesn't want the traditional beer or wine or cider. And because of that, we need to look into the non-alcoholic space and say, what is an alternative? What doesn't exist already in the alcoholic space? And, you know, this is obviously what we've come up with.
Well, and just the brand building strategies are completely different. I mean, you look at, or at least from my experience, I look at some of the decisions that are made in the non-alcoholic space, and they tend to be oftentimes more retail-driven, you know, wanting to kind of turn on thousands of, you know, grocery accounts with the flip of a switch, the types of distributor decisions that are being made versus alcohol, which is, you know, heavily regulated. The distribution decisions, you know, related to franchise laws are much more difficult and nuanced to kind of pick through. So, you know, sort of that going from startup to national brand, that runway is a lot longer. Do you guys see Briggs as a national brand at some point? And if so, you know, what's going to be sort of your strategy for getting to that point? Is it going to be retail driven or is it going to be, you know, sort of market by market, state by state, individual distributor by individual distributor?
That's a really good question. And I think that's a great point about how different the distribution strategy and channels are in the alcohol space compared to the non-alcohol space. Neil and I right now are really focused on deep diving and building a really strong nucleus in these markets locally. We've seen a lot of brands expand beyond their reach in terms of manpower and resources and have had to pull back product and kind of focus more on the backyard. And for us, you know, it's going to be a combination of pull and a combination of resources. But right now, we're really focused on making a deep dive into this market, creating those authentic relationships with the end consumers. And that's so important in a space right now where it's unclear where the direction is headed and the competition that's in the space. I think that for us, you know, we want to take a different approach than the rest of the competitors. And the only way to do that is by creating real authentic relationships with not only the end consumer, but the retailers as well.
Yeah. And long term, what's the goal for Briggs? I mean, do you guys envision this as a brand that could one day be sold to a larger company, be it alcohol or non-alcoholic? What's sort of the goal? What's the big dream?
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, we have a lot of room to expand and a lot of room to grow. We're super excited to bring Briggs, you know, just beyond Massachusetts or Rhode Island or even the New England area. That's very far down the line for us, I think. But, you know, we definitely feel that this product could appeal to all kinds of people all over the country. And, you know, ideally that ends up happening, whether it be through, you know, our own resources and our own expansion or, you know, with the aid and assistance of a larger company or under their wing or whatever the situation may be. We definitely feel like there's a market out there for this product, a very big one.
And not to give you too unspecific of an answer there, but we're taking this one day at a time. We look towards the future a lot, but I think that the progression of the company is happening so fast now. Even over the last 2 weeks when we launched this new line, so much has happened so quickly. And we're kind of taking a patient and calculated approach as to where when we see pull in certain areas, we're going to look at those opportunities and we're going to decide where we want to move from there. Being a small company, we have the ability to pivot quickly and make decisions based off of the information that we have. We're able to move on, whether it be new flavors or whatever it may be. And I think that we use that approach, being a kind of scrappy and shifty startup, to our advantage in that way.
Yeah. Well, you guys are in a pretty competitive space, even though there, you know, aren't a whole ton of brands, you know, maybe about a dozen or so out there with the mainstream players compared to, you know, 6,500 or whatever craft breweries that exist out there today. But you guys have an excellent product and wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers. All right, that was our interview with the founders of Briggs Hard Seltzer, Michael and Neil. A little bit of bad radio here. You guys out there in podcast land didn't get the opportunity to actually see them, but I think you could probably tell in their voices that they're pretty passionate about what they do. They're young, they're energetic. And, you know, it's great to see entrepreneurs entering a space like Hard Seltzer focused exclusively on the product as opposed to, you know, just introducing it as another line in, you know, a large portfolio of beer, cider, tea, you know, all different types of flavored malt beverages. They're exclusively focused on the Hard Seltzer product. Justin, what did you think of Neil and Michael?
I definitely picked up on the passion that you're talking about. You could tell that they're passionate. But the one thing I couldn't get out of my head was how hard it's going to be to compete in the hard seltzer space in the coming years. And you sort of laid out the case at the beginning because so many things have changed from when you recorded this in the summer. We now have, what, Oscar Blues in the game, Perrin, Noda. You add those, I'm missing somebody else there. Pabst is getting in the hard seltzer game.
Yeah.
So when you did the recording, there weren't as many entrants as there are now.
I think I said it was like a nascent category, and I recorded in June or July or so, and that's already an outdated comment. It's a thriving category now.
It's somewhere everyone wants to play, or at least a lot of people want to play in the space right now, and they see opportunity, which you've brought up over and over, I think, talking about your own personal experiences of going out, being in summer settings, and people don't care what you hand them. I think nobody's making a call out for a name brand.
Yeah, I think that's going to be probably the biggest difficulty, not only for Briggs, but for really anyone who's getting into the hard seltzer space is, you know, actually building a brand that is different than hard seltzer, right? And I think to some degree, you kind of see this in craft beer in a little bit of a different way, where it's like, for so long, there was the quote-unquote brand of craft beer, right? And it was like, as long as you were drinking a quote-unquote craft beer, that was a positive thing. And now with 7,000 breweries, it's become, you know, increasingly more difficult to differentiate and stand out. Well, in the hard seltzer space, the challenge is similar in that I think consumers really just they've ascribed a certain set of identities to hard seltzer, which is low calorie, healthier, better for you, that type of a thing, lower ABV. I think they know that all those qualities exist for hard seltzer, and they don't care much about the brand. The difference for Briggs, I think, is that, and we address this in the interview, is that if you pour out their product and you look at their product, it is colorful. I mentioned that it was similar to the experience of drinking a Spindrift. If you pull out a Spindrift, which is a non-alcoholic seltzer, it's colorful. And yet they're in this can. You can't see the liquid, right? And most people are probably drinking it from the can, not pouring it out. So I think that's going to be the thing that kind of sets them apart. And how they do that is going to be interesting. How they tell consumers, hey, we're different, and just you can see the difference, that's going to be the thing that they're going to have to figure out.
That's something that they definitely addressed, and it's going to take a lot of that dirty work, you know, that 15 to 20 samplings that they talked about that they're doing a week. It's definitely going to take that to get that point across, because you're right. They are sort of at a disadvantage that you can't visually see the difference. And the hard seltzer category is one where everything seems to be in the majority of the product, I should say, is in these slim cans. You can't see through it. And I think a lot of people have shifted away. I want to say that I had a bottle of Truly at one time.
Yeah.
But it seems like the shift is away from glass to, you know, slim cans.
Well, I think it kind of makes sense if you think about the occasions, or I guess the need state of a hard seltzer, which traditionally has been, you know, summertime, on a boat, on a beach, out in the outdoors, right? So I think that's another challenge, not only for Briggs, but for all hard seltzer companies, is how do you take the experience of drinking a hard seltzer and bring it into the periods where maybe you're not as inclined as a consumer to reach for a hard seltzer? And of course, I'm talking about, you know, like the cold winter months in New England. That's really not the first thing on my mind. And, you know, maybe all the, you know, sort of conventional wisdom goes out the window here because the consumer is changing, and maybe there is just a hard seltzer consumer out there that drinks it regularly all the time, regardless of what the weather is. And, you know, we give beer companies a hard time for blaming the weather. But I think in this case, like, it has been a product that is traditionally spiked in the summertime and kind of tapered off in the wintertime, right?
It is something I've heard about over and over again on these investor relations calls that Boston Beer does. Jim Cook has said, well, Truly is up, you know, they are cautiously watching the winter months because of that, you know, rise fall that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a challenge for every hard seltzer brand, is figuring out the way to speak to consumers during those winter months and, you know, I guess create that occasion, create the opportunity to have a seltzer. And some of that might actually be through the continued penetration of the on-premise segment, where I can't imagine that there's really much hard seltzer being sold on-premise right now, especially in the winter. But the two companies that did reach out to us in the last week or so, Perrin and Noda, they're both doing their hard seltzers on draft, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that stood out. I think Noda's brand's called Brizzo.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see how companies attack that on-premise space with a hard seltzer brand, because, you know, I think you look at some of the intrinsic qualities of at least some hard seltzers: gluten-free, low calorie, lower ABV, more fruit forward and kind of flavorful and, I guess, sweeter in a sense. And those are things that I would expect that retailers, you know, would want to push, on-premise retailers, that is. And traditionally, the product that they've done that with is cider. And cider's performing really well this year as well. So will they, you know, swap? Will they cut into space that cider had previously dominated and start putting seltzer in there? I don't know.
It brings me to the point of who's going to get those opportunities. we've got a category where it's largely dominated by three players, which is White Claw, Boston Beers Truly, and AB's Spiked Seltzer.
Yeah, well, and you can throw like Henry's from Miller Coors in there, Constellation's making some headway, Diageo. But yeah, those three.
So you've got those three at the lead. And if you already don't have placement, who do you think that retailers are going to gravitate toward first?
Yeah, and you know, maybe it'll be similar to the way that craft beer has developed, where companies like Briggs and like Platform and Perrin and Oscar Blues can, you know, start to seed the product in some of the higher end, more craft focused bars that, you know, want to have that offering available, but don't necessarily want to sell like a really mainstream product. I mean, those bars don't sell like Mike's Hard Lemonade, right?
Yeah.
So maybe they'll pick up a Briggs.
That makes total sense, too, because, and that plays to Briggs' advantage because they're positioning themselves as a premium hard seltzer.
Yeah, and actually, now that I think about it, I don't think Briggs has a draft product. And actually, the Brizzo is colored as well. I saw the photos. It does have some color to it. So it's not a clear product, and it is being poured on draft. That's actually the way to sell it, right? Is like you actually get to see the product coming out of the draft handle, and it's colorful.
If you've ever been anywhere like a beer festival where they're pouring a purplish tinged product, anything with color in the normal yellow or brown or black, you know,
world of beer.
Yes.
Yeah.
People gravitate towards that. They ask about it. So it is a major opportunity if they can achieve that.
Instagrammable, I think, is what they say.
Now, yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of something that maybe isn't Instagrammable, but certainly shareable and was shared a lot on Twitter, as we segue into our segments here, we have a new one for you. We're calling it Seriously, What the Fuck?
Seriously, What the Fuck?
This is truly a head scratcher, and I'll let you explain.
Oh, thanks. It's one of those stories that you look at your calendar and you say, wow, it's 2018, and this is a thing that actually still happens or ever happened?
I thought you were going to say April 1st because I thought we were being pranked.
It could have been. And, of course, we're talking about the situation with the St. Louis Brewery, maker of Schlafly.
Yep.
And Four Hands Brewing Company in St. Louis. And this is a story where Schlafly and Four Hands released a joint press release last week, Schlafly apologizing to Four Hands for a senior executive circulating a newsletter called Brew IQ in the Loo, which was sent to bars and restaurants in November and claimed that Four Hands was named after a sex act.
Yeah. That right there, right off the bat, I'm like lost because I don't consider myself to be an expert on Urban Dictionary lingo or anything, but I've literally never, like, I couldn't even, when I read that, I was like, what are they even referring to? I figured that in today's like meme culture, I would have seen something about this.
Exactly. It was definitely not something that was in my lexicon.
Yeah.
And let's take a look at what they wrote in Brew IQ in the Loo. Naming your brewery after a sex act provided at a massage parlor no longer feels as good. Naming a beer after the lube needed for such service feels even worse. Leave glamorizing a pimp's wad of dollars to the deuce. The deuce is an HBO show. The ladies are becoming woke.
Stay woke.
Stay woke, kids. The ladies are becoming woke and starting to ask questions. We'd like to give them a hand, but think the four are proving to be too many.
Yeah. Okay. So what was especially odd about this whole situation, so as it goes, St. Louis Brewery's CEO, James Pendergraf, is supposedly the man behind this random Brew IQ in the Loo newsletter that just appeared seemingly out of thin air. But the timeline is so odd because we had heard some rumblings that there might be something happening at Schlafly. And then I think it was like a couple days later, it was announced that he was retiring. Pendergraf, that is. And then was it the following day? The very next day?
I think it was 2 days later.
Two
I think
days
it was
later.
Like midweek he resigned. Or the statement from Schlafly was,
we have confirmed that he has resigned.
Yeah. How do you...
No context.
We have confirmed who's doing the reporting here.
Yeah, it was truly odd. And then like a day or two later, Four Hands issues this joint press release with Schlafly that said, you know, a senior executive had resigned because of this newsletter. They didn't name the senior executive, but I mean, you can connect the dots, right? And I think later it was confirmed that it was Pendergraph. I don't know if it was like Dispatch or one of the outlets had to actually confirmed it, I think.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just like wild. One, why would you even do that? And two, if this thing happened to me, like I'm going to try to get out ahead of the spin and just say, hey, look, our CEO fucked up. And this is what he said. And this is what happened. Instead, it was like this weird trickle out.
Tinfoil hat on. My conspiracy would be that maybe if you know that this is coming, you leak that you resigned.
But why?
I don't know. I mean, none of this makes sense.
No, none of it makes sense at all. Like,
one, I don't know that I would ever hire anybody as a chief executive who would think that this would be a proper strategy.
Yeah. Terrible idea.
There was probably more effort put into creating this newsletter than
figuring out the slumping sales.
Yeah.
I mean, weren't they down like 13%?
16 and 17.
I mean, that's just, if your sales are slowing over the course of 2 years and you're resorting to some slanderous newsletter to take a cheap shot at your local competitor, I mean, that's just the dumbest approach to solving a problem I can imagine.
And why Four Hands? Of all, they're not the only craft brewery that's probably taking share from Schlafly in St. Louis.
And if you're trying to go after a company for having provocative names or, I mean, like,
I've got one for you. Yeah. In Springfield, Mother's Brewing, which has since changed the name of the beer, but they had a beer called MILF.
Yeah, there you go.
So, and it was a seasonal release, but still, if you want to talk about, you know, provocative names.
Or offensive names.
That's actually one of them. Four Hands is actually named for the intertwined hands of co-founder Kevin Lemp, his wife, and their two children.
Yeah. So swing and a miss. And seriously, WTF. All right. Moving on. That was a truly odd way to close out 2018. But there are some other odd things that tend to creep up at the end of 2018. And that's usually these weird PR pitches that just, they fill our inboxes at the end of the year. There was one in particular that stood out, but some of the others that it's like, we got one from like Russia that was like a hangover cure. We get those all the time, but it was like, you know, they put the holiday spin on it. Like, you're going to be going to holiday parties, take our Russian hangover cure. It's like, I don't know if that's what I want to consume. What else do we get? Like the ugly sweaters?
Ugly sweaters. Things that don't even count, like Sigmund Freud's great-great-great-grandson or great-great-grandson.
I mean, we get some truly odd things. That one, I think, came from LinkedIn. But the holiday season is typically a time where news is a little bit slower. Everyone's pretty much, you know, done what they can do for the year. And they're trying to get this sort of last PR hit or this last boost. And it's always like, are you doing a cocktail roundup or a holiday beer roundup? We love, you know, insert website name here. We love your content. And it's just these really awful pitches. Well, one was actually, I did see some coverage of it. It did get picked up.
Oh, it did get picked up.
Yeah, I did see somebody pick it up. It was like, maybe it was like CNBC or something like that. But it was this odd survey that was conducted by OnePoll and Founders Brewing of all breweries, where they polled 1,000 beer drinkers to determine the types of personalities that they have based on the types of beer that they consume. And they split it up into lager and ale. And what did they find, Justin?
They found a lot of different things. Among them, lager drinkers report higher stress levels than ale drinkers. Mm. While lager lovers are more likely to show up for work on time, ale drinkers are more likely to say they're happy with their job.
Hmm.
Which one are you, Chris? Are you a lager drinker or an ale drinker?
Well, I was late today.
Oh, shit. We know what you are then.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, it says ale drinkers are bigger flirts and they like new challenges and they're happier. I like challenges.
Do you make $38,000 a year?
No, I do not make $38,000 a year, but I also don't make $41,000 a year, which is a pretty small gap between a lager and an ale drinker. So those were the average salaries.
You exercise probably, what, 7 times a week?
Yeah, every day.
Yeah.
So more than 4 to 5 hours a week, which is, again, the difference negligible. A lager drinker exercises 4 hours a week. An ale drinker exercises 5 hours a week. Lager drinkers are more likely to be into sports, though, oddly enough.
Ale drinkers are more artsy.
But yet they work out more?
Yeah, right?
I don't know. That seemed kind of odd to me. Ale drinkers are also more likely to prefer cats, so...
Because lager drinkers are more of a dog people who like to watch Game of Thrones or Big Bang Theory or Law & Order. I cannot
make any of this out.
You cannot glean anything from this, right?
Like, no. I don't understand why they divide it into lager ale. Like, they would be better suited doing, like, beer, wine, spirits or something like that, not dividing in between beer, because you kind of drink all different types of beer if you're a beer drinker, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, in a poll run by founders, I kind of would like to see the methodology here, because who are these 1,000 beer drinkers that they polled?
And what was the point? Like, I don't understand the point. How do lager and ale drinkers compare? But, like, why do I care about this?
The one thing that probably stuck out the most on this is two things. 36% of beer drinkers say they're intimidated by craft beer.
Okay.
And 6:31 p.m. on a Friday is the best time to have a beer.
Well, I would agree with that.
I would probably go a little earlier, but sure.
Earlier than 6? Well, I like to work out, so.
Yeah.
And I'm more likely to be a sports person. I'm a lager drinker, I guess.
I guess you are.
I guess I am goal-oriented. I am hardworking. I am quite worried about the future and very stressed, and I do love meeting new people.
Mm.
I'm confident, but I am not punctual. I'm a lager drinker.
You're a lager drinker. I actually think you are a lager drinker, to be honest with you.
The personality traits
you
would say that I'm a lager drinker.
More than that, I've had beers with you. You usually get something, you know, Pilsner, lager.
That's true. I have been drinking a lot of Pilsner lately. All right. Well, I'll give it up to founders then. They got me pegged.
Mike Stevens, congrats. You turned him around.
Yeah, I'm going to be drinking nothing but solid gold for the rest of the year. Congratulations. All right, and lastly, before we let you all go, we have buy 'em a beer. That's buy 'em a beer, non-gender specific pronouns for this one. And buy 'em a beer is the Monopoly Man. Buy 'em a beer is back. The Monopoly Man is back. Everybody knows the Monopoly Man. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Rich Uncle Pennybags is the Monopoly Man's official name. It's the caricature that kind of looks like the Planner's peanut guy. He's got the top hat. He's got the monocle. He's got the mustache. Anyways, there is an individual in Washington, D.C. who goes by the name of Ian, who is an activist, a political activist of some kind, and shows up to these congressional hearings and basically protests corporate America by dressing up as Rich Uncle Pennybags. And this person, Ian, sat in like the most perfect position during the congressional hearing with Google CEO, what his name is, like Sundar, I believe, Sundar Pichai. I think I'm getting that right, Sundar Pichai. And basically the camera was just positioned on this monocle-wearing individual, like, the entire time.
It just keeps popping up in the frame, monocle dropping.
I mean, some of the best GIFs. GIFs or GIFs?
GIFs,
GIFs.
Think.
Some of the best GIFs that you will ever see is this individual who just kind of creeps out of nowhere and, like, puts the monocle on. And then, like, you know, as the day wore on, it went from this, like, small mustache to this giant mustache to, like, 2 mustaches on the top hat. I mean, this thing had me in stitches this week.
I have a conspiracy on this, too.
Okay.
I think Big Board Game might be involved here.
Ooh, okay.
Big Board Game, it's the holiday season. Big Board Game's jumping in here.
Yeah, a little
trying
viral.
Trying to get some, go viral, get some sales. We're not just talking about slumping beer sales here. Slumping Monopoly sales.
Oh, well, I blame millennials. Because
I think that's who we're supposed to blame.
Millennials have killed the board game industry, as
you
know. But have no fear, because I have a great idea. And maybe this already exists, but maybe millennial Monopoly. Maybe they make a millennial edition where you just start in tons of debt and everybody blames you for everything. How about that?
I think that's a perfect game.
There we go. Well, one of these giant board game manufacturers. What are some of the board game manufacturers?
Milton Bradley, Milton Parker Bradley. Brothers.
There you go. Milton Bradley.
Who makes Monopoly?
Well, that's a good question. We'll have to answer that on next week's podcast.
I guess so.
Or we can get our stats team on it. Hey, stats team, look up who makes Monopoly.
We've got such a big staff here that we're able to have a statistician on staff.
Well, our statistician has just pulled it up, okay? And it is the Parker Brothers.
Parker Brothers.
Yeah.
We're watching you. We know. We know what you're up to.
Yeah, there you go.
In the meantime, somebody buy Ian a beer.
Actually, maybe it's Hasbro. Did they buy the Parker Brothers?
Oh, we've got a whole rabbit hole here.
Oh, boy. Well, we will get to that next week as we peruse Wikipedia and find all of our answers on the board game industry. In the meantime, if you find the Monopoly Man in Washington, D.C., for our listeners who are out there in D.C., if you find Ian, and I believe this person's on Twitter, you can look him up. We'll share it. We'll share this person's Twitter. Buy him a beer. I say buy him a beer because
buy him a beer.
I laughed my ass off this week, and I am going to continue to laugh my ass off at all the forthcoming GIFs. And
use them.
And I'm going to use them. Some of the most hysterical stuff I've ever witnessed was a Monopoly Man character in a congressional hearing. Only in America does this happen. Thank you, C-SPAN. All right, that's our show for this week. Thank you to everyone for tuning in, whether you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, or SoundCloud. We don't care where you listen. We just love that you're listening to us. If you like what we're doing, please leave us a rating and a review and share the podcast with your friends. We also want to roll out a new mailbag segment where you can send us your thoughts on our interviews or shoot us some questions that you'd like us to answer. So drop us a line, podcast@brewbound.com. Got something you want us to sound off on, want us to read your thoughts on air, or question what our guests are saying, hit us up, podcast@brewbound.com. And of course, thank you to our audio team, our guests, Michael and Neil from Briggs, and everyone out there in beer and seltzer land. Catch us next week for episode 15, which features an interview with Jim Woods, the founder of Woods Beer Company. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.